people too.
At this time of great pain, you choose to be together.
If not now, when?
I wanted to break the cycle of incitement, hatred, violence, revenge, rinse and repeat.
How can we move further away from this hashtag stand with Palestine or a hashtag stand with Israel?
If we are not able to grieve the loss of our humanity together, we will never be able to plan a future together.
Those who believe that bombs will bring safety, they are naive. They are naive.
We lost our compass of humanity, and we need to bring that back.
The idea that I should care more about a dead child who happens to be of someone who shares my nationality as opposed to someone who does not is insane to me.
The path forward includes the stories of Palestinian peace activist Aziz Abu Sara and Israeli peace activist Ma'oz Inon, who we just interviewed on this show. His parents, Bilha and Yaakov Inon, were killed in the October 7th attack. In this clip, The Path Forward, Aziz begins by talking about reaching out to Ma'oz after news of Ma'oz's parents' death a year ago today.
It didn't matter to me that Ma'oz's parents were Jewish. That's not part of the calculation. When people talk about October 7th, it's Israelis versus Palestinians. It didn't feel to me Israelis versus Palestinians. Those who were hurt, those who were killed were my people too.
I just replied immediately, thank you for being there.
A few days later, he made a post on Twitter.
I am not crying for my parents. I am crying for those who will lose their lives in this war.
He doesn't want revenge, and he doesn't want what's happened to him to cause more people to suffer. And I said, it took me 8 years to come to that point. When my brother, Taysir, died, he was 19 years old, and I was 10 years old. He was arrested on suspicion of throwing rocks. He was beaten up in prison by an Israeli soldier, which caused internal injuries. He died as a result of those injuries. Well, still painful. A few days after Ma'oz's parents were killed, it's just I can't imagine stepping out of your pain to think of somebody else's pain, to think of what other people are going through. It takes so much of a humanity of someone to do that. So I wrote him that, and he sent me a message right away saying, let's talk.
I knew that my life has changed dramatically. It's not just what happened to my parents, my childhood friends, Israelis. I knew that a war is just about to happen, and a war that we have never experienced before in our lifetime. So every contact, every bridge, every relationship that I knew that I would be able to build with Palestinians, it's very meaningful, not just for me, Ma'oz, as a person, but for the region.
An excerpt from The Path Forward featuring Ma'oz Inon, who lost his parents a year ago today, and Aziz Abu Sara, Palestinian peace activist, who's joining us now from Greenville, South Carolina. He's also author and founder of Mejdi Tours and a resident of East Jerusalem. When Aziz Abu Sara was 9 years old, as you just heard, his older brother Taysir died soon after his release from an Israeli prison of internal injuries suffered after he was tortured in prison. And here in New York, Julie Cohen is with us, the Oscar-nominated filmmaker who's made many films, including RBG, My Name is Pauli Murray, Gabby Giverts Won't Back Down. Julie is a Jewish American and co-directed The Path Forward with Mo Husseini, a Palestinian American writer. We thank you both for being with us. Aziz, your thoughts on this October 7th anniversary?
It's been a hard morning already just listening to news, and I've talked to Ma'oz already this morning, been in touch with some friends, but it's been not just the anniversary of October 7th, it's this whole year has been like a nightmare that I keep wishing I can wake up and just forget all about it and assume that, you know, believe that was just a dream, just a nightmare. And unfortunately, it hasn't. Tens of thousands of people have been killed. So much pain, so much suffering. So many people I know, both Palestinians and Israelis and Lebanese, are suffering. My family are all in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. It's every time I get a phone call, I'm terrified of receiving horrible news. It's been impossible to have a normal life in this last year. It is impossible to have a normal life. So it's just a reminder of how far we've gotten in a negative way, in a terrible way.
And Julie Cohen, can you talk about focusing on Aziz and Maoz, Palestinian-Israeli peace activists, in this year of so much suffering?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a day of grief today. As Aziz says, there's this sort of ongoing nightmare to work to wake up to every day. For me personally, and for Maud, my directing partner in this, in a way, finding and sharing the voices of Aziz and Maoz and other pairs like them, because there are many, many more like this, is the greatest comfort to the nightmare, and possibly, you know, the only hope in our minds of a solution, of a moving forward, of looking at the horrendous situation the world is in. People who've suffered the greatest pain, like Aziz and Maoz, who take that pain and think, wait a second, how can we go for, as Maoz said earlier, radical reconciliation, radical peace, a radical search for justice? Like, in some ways, looking for love and compassion and sharing pain and sharing grief is better than the militaristic solutions, quote unquote, which have failed us again and again and again. And so we just wanted to bring their voices forward because they seem useful and constructive in a world where there is too little usefulness right now.
In your film, you have woven throughout this a peace march of Palestinian and Israeli Jewish women that happened on October 4th, 3 days before last year's October 7th. One of the people leading this march was Vivian Silver, the well-known Canadian-Israeli peace activist who would die on her kibbutz. We have interviewed her son demanding a ceasefire from the beginning, as Maoz and Aziz have.
Yes. You know, it's a sadness almost that more of us weren't aware of this march when it originally happened on October 4th, how little American news coverage this got, that the fact that a couple thousand women, Palestinian and Israeli Jewish women, together linking arms, singing, calling, crying out for peace. And I think what's so beautiful is how many of the activists, including those featured in our film, did not react to everything that was to come just a few days later by pulling apart, but it actually strengthened their resolve, you know, to like, no, this shows that what we need is something new and different, and let's work together towards building improvement, building a better world.
Let me ask Aziz, if you feel more or less hope right now, you have Israel in the most massive, deadly bombardment of Lebanon that we have seen in decades. You have the bombing of Iran. You have Iran's missiles on Israel. You have the bombing of Israel's bombing of Syria, Israel's bombing of Yemen. As we wrap up, what gives you hope?
Well, I want to just say something before I tell you what gives me hope. Is Vivian was a dear friend who I've known for many, many years and was a mentor for me. And that image of Israelis and Palestinians marching together has not changed. That's what gives me hope. I was in Jerusalem just 3 weeks ago, and we went marching in Al-Awja, in a Palestinian village in the West Bank, that the water was diverted away from the village to a settlement. And Israelis arrived from Tel Aviv, Israelis arrived from Jerusalem, Israelis arrived from all over, joining Palestinians, and we marched together. And I saw something powerful, is even though we were only few hundred, the fear of those who opposed us, you know, the army and the police, even though we were extremely peaceful, compliant, we didn't want to confront anyone, we marched with messages that says we refuse to be enemy, water rights for everyone, these kind of very universal language. And they were terrified. And in some ways, that gave me a little hope, because I can see how people who believe that war is the only way, what scares them the most is people like us. What scares them the most is people who are modeling a different future, that we're able to say, look, we don't hate each other. We can work together. And so it was no surprise that the police came and gave traffic tickets to everyone pretty much who arrived. It was no surprise that the military was trying to provoke us, because they were terrified that we are showing what the possibility is. So I do have hope. And my hope is not in leaders or politicians who claim to be leaders. My hope is in about the people who are like us, my colleagues, Israelis and Palestinians, who are refusing to fall into, if I'm Palestinian, I must hate all Israelis or Jews, or if I'm Israeli, I must hate all Palestinians, and realizing that we are on the same side. Those of us who believe in equality, in justice, in peace, and those who don't yet, our mission is to convince those who don't yet to join us and realize that bombing somebody else, killing a civilian, killing a human being, is never going to be the way to bring you safety and security, and that our route to freedom is a joint route.
And finally, we just have 30 seconds. The path forward, where can it be seen, Julie?
You should be following myself at Filmmaker Julie and at Mohu on our socials. We're moving towards more screenings of this film and getting it out where everyone can see it online very soon, because of the urgency of Aziz and Moe's message and all the others that are involved in this really significant work.
We want to thank you, Oscar-nominated filmmaker Julie Cohen, co-directed The Path Forward with a Palestinian writer, Mo Husseini. And I want to thank Aziz Abusara, Palestinian peace activist featured in the film. Coming up, we go to Durban, South Africa, where we'll be joined by Palestinian poet Mosab Abu Toha, then to Beirut. Stay with us. By Edwin Starr. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to look at Gaza, as Israel's military has launched a new offensive on northern Gaza. Over the weekend, Israel ordered more than 300,000 Palestinians to flee. Israel's latest mass evacuation order came on the one-year anniversary of the start of its brutal war on Gaza, following Hamas's attack on October 7th. Over the weekend, Israeli forces attacked a mosque and a school sheltering displaced people in Deir al-Balah, killing at least 26 Palestinians. The official death count in Gaza is nearing 42,000, but believed to be much higher. We're joined now by Mosab Abu Toha, Palestinian poet and author. He left Gaza in December after being detained by the Israeli military. His essay in the New York Times, published Sunday, is headlined, "Gaza's schools are for learning, not for dying." And his latest piece for The New Yorker magazine is "The Pain of Traveling while Palestinian. He's a columnist, teacher, founder of the Edward Said Library in Gaza, author of the award-winning book titled Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza. His second book of poetry will be out next week. It's titled Forest of Noise. Mossab, welcome back to Democracy Now! We talked to you right after you came out of Gaza. We also spoke to you in Gaza. You had been detained by the Israeli military. Your thoughts on this anniversary of both the Hamas attack and the beginning of the slaughter of Palestinians by the Israeli military in Gaza?
Thanks so much, Amy, for hosting me and for this platform. My thoughts is that whereas the Israelis were able to bury their dead after October 7th, there are just thousands of Palestinians whose bodies were not found because of the Israeli airstrike, the intense Israeli airstrikes, and others whose bodies were left still under the rubble of their houses. I lost 30 members of my extended family, 3 first cousins, 2 of whom with their husbands and their children. And I haven't been able to bid them farewell. Some of them, they had nothing in their bodies left for me to look at them. And many of them are still under the rubble because there is no fuel, there is no equipment to remove the rubble from above the bodies. So it is really devastating to think that after a year, the world is still thinking about the October 7th only, rather than about the years and decades before October 7th and the many and long, long days and weeks that followed October 7th.
If you can respond to the Pope calling for a ceasefire in Lebanon, in Gaza, the French President Macron calling for an end to weapon sales to Israel, the U.S. continuing those weapon sales, though President Biden has said he wants a ceasefire, and these latest attacks in Gaza.
I mean, it's really funny when someone says that we need to achieve a ceasefire as soon as possible. This is what President Biden and Kamala Harris are asking for. But at the same time, they never stopped sending bombs to Israel. And they never even took any measures to stop Israel from invading humanitarian areas and from targeting humanitarian aid trucks when they enter Gaza. So instead of monitoring whatever bombs and weapons get into Israel, not only sending Israel weapons, but instead of monitoring whatever bombs Israel is using against the civilian population and even the tent areas where there are only tents there, there is even no house. There are even no houses there. So instead of monitoring the weapons that are getting into Israel and the kind of weapon that Israel is dropping, They are keeping a very close eyes on the kind of trucks and the kind of foods and biscuits and lunch on canned food into Gaza. So, and this is something that I wish I could hear after Palestine was occupied in 1948. Weapons should have stopped being sent to Israel, not in 2023 or 2024. It should have been stopped, you know, after 1948, and they should have called for a ceasefire. You know, and the halt of settlement construction in the West Bank and the expansion of settlements. They should have called for all of these, not only for a ceasefire, because a ceasefire does not lead to peace. There should be justice. And all those who care about Palestinian lives, why don't you recognize them as a people, as people who should have their political rights, not only to look at them as victims of Israeli terrorism?
You were a teacher in Gaza. So many schools in Gaza have been hit. So many were turned into shelters and then still hit by the Israeli military. You write in your New York Times column, on Saturday morning, I learned from my school's WhatsApp group that my most talented student, Hatem al-Zanin, had been killed in Beit Hanun, where Israel that day carried out strikes. Can you talk, as we wrap up, about your students, about your colleagues, those who are dead and alive, your own family, and how it's coped with leaving Gaza today?
Just to honor my student, his name is Hatem al-Zanin. I would like to pronounce his name the way he used to tell me his name when I first met him. Hatem's hope was to to join me in the States when he grows up. I promised him, literally. When he was one of the only few students who kept in touch with me when I was in Syracuse doing my MFA 2 years ago. And he kept in touch. When are you going to come back? I need you to teach me. I love all teachers, but I want you to teach me. I love your teaching. And I told him, you know, when you grow up, you should come to this country. It's very beautiful. People here are really beautiful, and the universities are really magnificent. And I told him, I will help you apply for a scholarship to come to the States. He was very, very brilliant, and he won a short story competition. And I still have the video on my phone of him reciting the short story that he picked for the contest. I mean, this is Hatem. And he was not, I mean, first I thought he was killed in a municipality building where he was sheltering with his family. But later a teacher corrected this to me early today, that Hatem was looking for firewood to help his family bake and cook food. And Israel is not only blocking the entrance of food trucks, but they are also killing people who are looking for ways to survive. So children like Hatem and my siblings and their children, they are not living. They are only spending their time trying to survive. And there is no place that's safe in Gaza. Very important, Annie. You mentioned that Israel ordered people in North Gaza North Gaza used to have about 1 million people, but now with the evacuations, now I think the number is about 400,000 people, including my father, three of my siblings and their children. Today they ordered, and also my wife's family, all of them are in North Gaza right now, and they're looking for ways to evacuate, but they don't know where. So they ordered Beit Lahia, Jabalia, and Beit Hanun to evacuate. And an hour after that, they ordered three areas in Khan Yunis, in South Gaza, to evacuate. So it's the thing is not about evacuating. So people are evacuating from North Gaza to South Gaza, and then they find themselves bombed in South Gaza. So they are cramming people there. And I thought, I was asked a lot of time by a friend, dear friend of mine, after October 7, why are you not going south? The Israelis are telling me to go south. Why are you going to go south? I told them, well, do you have any guarantee that I will make it alive south? And then the second question, do you guarantee that I will be safe in South Gaza? Is there any place that's called safe? And safety is not about not being killed by shrapnel or by airstrike. Safety is about finding food, finding water, finding medicine. There is nothing in South Gaza even. So wherever you go, there is nothing that's called a humanitarian area.
Mossab, we are going to have you back on to talk about your new book of poetry. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Mossab Abu Toha, Palestinian poet and author. His new book out next week is called Forest of Noise. He's speaking to us today from Durban, South Africa. South Africa has brought a genocide case against Israel to the International Court of Justice.
If I have a moment, I'm here to participate in a poetry festival that I was invited to, and I'm based right now in upstate New York.
Thank you, Mossab. We end today's show in Lebanon, where Israel has launched its heaviest bombardment to date on Beirut and the city's southern suburbs. Earlier today, Israeli warplanes bombed a fire station in southern Lebanon, killing at least 8 people. Israel's assault has now displaced 1.2 million people in Lebanon. Many have fled to Beirut from the south.
We have been displaced for 10 days now. We don't have food with us. You are not able to even go and bring new clothes. We left our homes and came here. Every night there's a strike. You cannot sleep. We came here and we are unable to go back from where we came. Our situation is terrible. If someone is able to find any way to get out of the country, they should. It's better than living on aid.
On Sunday, Hezbollah fired rockets at the Israeli port city of Haifa. In Beirut, we're joined by Rima Majid. She's an assistant professor of sociology at the American University of Beirut. You're speaking to us from Beirut, where these massive explosions rocked the city over the weekend, marking the most violent night of Israeli attacks in recent weeks. We're hearing reports of Israeli strikes pounding southern Beirut and a massive airstrike on Sunday near the city's international airport. Describe what it's like to be there, Rima.
Thank you so much, Amy. I mean, it's of course horrible to be here. It's our nights are very long. Unfortunately, the heaviest bombing happens at night when people are getting ready to go to bed. The past weekend and the week and the weeks before have been really horrible. I mean, this week it's been mainly Beirut, but the south, the Bekaa and other areas have been very heavily hit in the weeks before. The situation is really very, very, very dire. I mean, I can go on for hours describing how horrible this whole situation is. I mean, this is also a country where there's already, it's a country that's already suffering from multiple crises in the past 5 years, from one of the worst financial crises in the world. You know, the port explosion in 2020, of course, COVID and its aftermath, earthquake last year. And a political deadlock that where at the moment we have no president, a caretaker government and a parliament that has not convened since the beginning of this war. So we are talking about a situation that is very difficult. What I want to talk about is the effects of these bombs are massive, not just at, I mean, of course, at the humanitarian scale, but I think the humanitarian aspect is something that people have become, it's become very, very dehumanizing to just focus on humanitarianism. We're talking about bare life here. All we care about is for people to just have shelter and food and be safe. We're forgetting about, lives of millions of people that are put on hold, dreams that are put on hold, social worlds that are disrupted. An everyday life that has changed in drastic ways overnight. I made it to this studio very late because I couldn't drive from a distance that is very close to here that usually takes 3 or 4 minutes. It took me 45 minutes and I couldn't continue the road. I had to be picked up on a motorbike to get here because of how crammed the city has become. So the effects of this are going to be immense for months, if not years, to come. Israel is using a tactic that we've seen in Gaza. It's raising whole areas. I mean, the Dahid, the southern suburb of Beirut, and many areas in the south and the Bekaa are being completely destroyed, which means people will have nowhere to go back to. These orders of evacuation are also, I mean, it's the same absurdity that my, friends in Gaza are describing. I mean, when we tell people to evacuate, but go where? It's very hard to find shelter in these conditions. People are sleeping in the streets. Winter is coming. It's starting to rain in Beirut. We're starting to talk about the possibility of epidemics spreading. So this is really a huge, catastrophe, and it's not a humanitarian one. It is a political catastrophe, and it's a social catastrophe.
And Professor Majid,
this would not have happened if it wasn't for the.
Go ahead. This wouldn't have happened if it weren't for.
If it wasn't for the backing and the arming of Israel.
And your response, we have just a minute, to Israel saying they're just destroying, trying to destroy Hezbollah. They're telling everyone else to leave, to protect them.
Yeah, we've heard the same thing in Gaza. They're just trying to destroy Hamas. I mean, two things. First, it's important to understand who Hezbollah is. Hezbollah, of course, is a political and military organization, but Hezbollah is also has a social base, and these are not people that are involved in military action.
Rima, we have just 15 seconds.
The other thing that I want to highlight is that the war of Israel on Lebanon has not started with the creation of Hezbollah in 82. Israel has invaded Lebanon way before 82. Hezbollah was created as a result of the Beirut invasion in 82. So the aim, I think, is not just Hezbollah, but the aim is to kill any possible resistance to a state
Rima
that
Majid,
is,
we're
that has
gonna leave
no
it there from the American
expansive.
University of Beirut, but we're going to do part two and post it online at democracynow.org. Stay with us, please. I'm Amy Goodman. Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.